You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
Boys, I'm mellow as a honeydew. Yeah.
That cat is high. Look that look in his eye. Oh, man, he's high. Yes, higher than a kite. That cat is high.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. In the studio today, we have some very special guests. That's not to say that all my guests aren't special. But I'm very happy to have in the studio Jill DeGroff, accompanied by some guy. Kidding, Dale DeGroff. So I am very excited about the new book that you just put out. This is your second volume, right?
It is.
Outside of the bar, there's a lot of stuff going on, you know. It tends to be kind of like a clubhouse, you know, like bartenders and bar culture. And some people think that it's not very inviting at times.
Oh, no, it's so...
Some people think that, though. But what's cool about what you're doing, like, if anyone has ever done anything that is so close to the bar culture, but not being a bartender, it's what you're doing. And you do these amazing illustrations and paintings of people on that side of the business, you know? And, like, these... Because there's so many characters...
Oh, that's great, like, characters.
You know, they're yeah. We're all pretty silly, and we have...
On both sides of the bar.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, what's cool about your illustrations, too, is it really showcases the playfulness, but also the seriousness of, like... To me, that's what I get from it. You know, it's very... Like, even, you know, like with Frank Cisneros, with the drawing that you did of him. I mean, he's a goofy guy.
Yeah.
And his smile, the way you got his smile, you know, it's brilliant.
Oh, he cries out for a caricature. Yeah, so do you. There are so many great characters, and but when some faces are just, you know, they're cry out for caricature, and they're just they're a graphic. Yeah. Frank's a graphic, you know.
Absolutely.
And I've just been very lucky to be able to meet all these mixologists, this community, the characters you see in New Orleans when we all converge at Tales of the Cocktail. And
oh, man, I don't know if I want that to be documented anyway. What was your initial inspiration to start doing the drawings of all these people? I mean, like, did you go to school for it? Was it something you've always just done? I mean, like,
I did go to Art Students League, and I later I've always done life drawing classes, and I started drawing mainly on the 7th Avenue IRT subway.
Oh, cool!
And when I was 15 years old, and new to Manhattan, and just bewitched by all the different kinds of faces and all the different neighborhoods, and living in edgy neighborhoods like the Upper West Side, the Lower East Side, you know.
Yeah. Did you, you said when you were new to Manhattan, where did you come from?
I grew up in the suburbs.
Oh.
Where everybody looked alike. And the other place that I was always drawing was at bars listening to jazz, hanging out with Dale, and we spent all those hours in bars, and it was just, I always like to keep my hands busy.
Yeah. So I mean, like, that's, to me, I mean, that's one of the biggest testaments to, at least, you know, the two books that you've put out. Like, it's really cool to, we all got into bartending because we like hanging out at bars, you know.
Yeah.
And we all, I mean, everyone likes hanging out at bars. I mean, how could you not? And there's so much life. And
for the longest time, I didn't know. I was giving away the drawings. I'd be sketching them at the bar, and it was a great way to connect with people, and then I would give them away. And then I guess it was Veronica. We have a crazy friend, Veronica the Romaniac. And she said, "No, don't you give that away. Don't you give that away." And actually, that was about the time when we were all getting into computers, and I could actually bring it home, scan it, and email it to people. Mm-hmm. We entered a whole nother era.
Yeah.
And so instead of giving them away, because I always felt like I owe somebody after I draw their portrait. I want to give them something back. And so I started collecting them. And I had done hundreds by then, but I had nothing to show for it. And then I deliberately started keeping them, scanning them. But the problem is, how do you put together a book if you don't have any, you know, like a storyline? And so I was trying to figure out, well, you know, how's this going to come together? And, you know, and I didn't. And then finally I started getting a story from everybody. Mm-hmm. And that, sometimes it's real, it happened when we went to... I'll tell you when it happened. On New Year's Day, we were at McSorley's.
I love
that place. And Dale should tell this story because he's really good at telling this story about meeting Matthew Marr.
Matthew's he's the owner, but he doesn't call himself the owner. He calls himself the caretaker because he got the job in a very strange way. He met the owner of Clark's on a lonely road in Ireland, and the owner's of Clark's Cadillac had broken down. But I won't get into that whole story. That's how he met him. Years later, let's just say he ended up owning the joint.
Owner of McSorley's.
I'm sorry, McSorley's.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get confused. Anyway, McSorley's, Jill's drawing this guy. And she said, "Dale, you got to go ask him for permission to use the drawing because I might use it in a book or whatever." I said, "Okay." So I walk up and I said, "Excuse me, sir. My wife's an artist. She's sitting right over there. And she's actually drawn this nice caricature of you. And she might be using it in a book or something, and she thought maybe you would give her permission to do that." He said, "Ah, no problem." He said, "Oh, that's great. Thank you very much." And he said, "My name is Matthew Marr, by the way. I own the joint." And I said, "You own the joint? I've been coming here since I was 18 years old, and I've wanted to meet the owner. I'm so happy I'm standing next to you." He said, "But I have one question for you. All these years I've been coming here, I look at these wishbones that are hanging on the gas lamp up there, and with all the stalactites of dust hanging down from them, and I'm wondering, what is that?" He said, "Oh, you don't know." I said, "Honest, I don't." He says, "Yeah, I don't know when exactly it started. It may be the First World War, not sure, but, you know, when the fellows went off the floor from the neighborhood here, they'd bring in a wishbone, they'd hang it up there, and when they come back, they'd break it for good luck, and, well, these are the fellows that didn't come back."
Oh, yeah.
And I said, "Wow." And from that moment on, I've referred to that kind of neighborhood community joint as having surroundings of substance, because how can you create that? That just is.
Yeah, it, that just happens. you can't make that up.
Oh, but the rest of the story. We said, so I said, "So how do you get into this business anyway?" And he said, "Ah, no, you don't want to hear that, you know." And I said, "Oh, no, please tell us." And then he launches into this wonderful story. "It was a dark and stormy night, and I was torn up in here."
In Ireland.
Yeah. And he started telling the story of how he met the owner of McSorley's. They got into like a fender bender. And this guy jumped out of the car. And
Matthew was a commercial driver, driving a meat truck.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Guy jumped out of the car, and he, Matthew was behind him, and he jumped into Matthew's car. Anyway, it's in the first book, how he tells it, and word for word. And they end up realizing they're from the same little hometown in Ireland, and they get on a bender for like 3 days together.
And all the meat in the back of the truck
meat rocks.
Spoils, right?
That's awesome.
And by the, you know, by the end of the 3 days, you know, the guy says, "Hey, if you, you know, if you ever come to New York, stop in McSorley's. I own the joint." And Matthew was going to become a sheep herder
in Australia.
Yeah, in Australia.
So he said, "I'll stop on the way."
Yeah, so wait a minute.
He had a family who were sheep herders in Australia, and he said, "I'm going through New York. I'll stop on the way." Remember?
Why was he going through New York?
Because that's where he had to fly to Australia. He was going to New York first. And he never made it to Australia. Long story.
He never
short.
Left.
Yeah. Nice.
That was 1969.
And when the old man was on the way out, he said to Matthew, who worked had by then had worked his way through every job in McSorley's, from mopping the floors to bartender, he said, "So, Matthew, what do you want to do?" And Matthew said, "Well, I kind of like to own a joint like this." He said, "I was hoping you'd say that."
It's yours.
It's yours.
He didn't have to, like, no, it was no money change.
That's how things happened, honest to God.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
well,
that's
by amazing. That time, he had been working there for 35 years.
Oh, well, sure. Yeah, that's sweat equity. That's, like, a really long sweat equity job. That's awesome. And, like, I love stories like that. And this is one of my favorite reasons why I like it.
And I realized I had to get a story from everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Not always so easy.
Yeah, sometimes people don't give their story.
It's a dying art, storytelling.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which is why I love doing this radio show, because I get everyone's story, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and so, like, and it's really cool that we have that visual that you're doing to go along with these things, you know?
Yeah.
Who are some of your favorite storytellers behind it? Besides
old Irish guys.
Yeah.
Dale. Dale's a champion storyteller. Gary Reagan, you know, the people who Dale used to be a real carouser. He never came home. And
we don't have to get into all those stories.
Okay. And so the people he used to hang out with, I mean, they were all such champion storytellers. John Molinari, oh my God. And so it was... You know, some of these guys who love bars, and they love bars not only because they love drinking, but they also love to spin a good yarn.
Yeah, and it's not always just about the drink. I mean, it's about the environment. It's about everything.
Camaraderie.
Yeah, you know, the camaraderie. You know, I just started rewatching Cheers because it just became available, the entire series. Became available on Netflix, so I've been watching Cheers again. I remember watching it growing up, like, but it's so cool, like that whole, like, you could basically sum up like the whole like camaraderie and the feeling of being in that kind of atmosphere in like the first episode, and it's such a cool thing to be able to do that, you know.
Yeah,
that's where I've met most of my friends.
Right.
And most of my friends work at those bars.
And the best storytellers are people who've really lived varied life and worked in lots of different places, lived in different places. You know, Michael Waterhouse is another person who comes to mind. And when he and Angela and Dale get together, they are shooting the stories such interesting.
Michael, by the way, was the owner of Dylan Prime down at Tribeca for many, many years.
Cool. Hey, I've been curious about this. How did you two meet? Was it one of these situations?
You can tell the story.
Oh. You know, I was going to email you and say, like, what kind of questions are you going to ask me tomorrow?
No, we're just talking. This is the cool thing about this show is, like, it's basically what we would do if we were sitting at a bar right now. It's the exact conversations. We just have microphones.
Dale and I met in Hollywood. And the introduction...
I wasn't ready for that.
Yeah. And the introduction to my first book tells that whole funny story, and it's a really funny story because... Dale, why don't you tell it?
Ah, you tell it. You tell it, girl.
That's what we're going to be battling, you know, back and forth. I moved to Los Angeles, and I had $300 in my pocket and a backpack, and I met just, you know, too many weird characters in Los Angeles.
Oh yeah.
And
tell us about a couple of those weird characters.
Don't be shy. Tell us about everything.
I had to get out where I was. You know, for a while I stayed at the Hollywood Y, and then I found a place in North Hollywood, and this guy ended up, you know, and I was working at Scholastic Books. I was a paste-up artist, and I didn't realize you needed a car to live in L.A.
Oh,
I was commuting an hour and a half by bus, by three different buses, to Culver City, you know, working at Scholastic Books, and I come back, and after a while I realized that this guy who I was renting his like back little house garage from, he was a pimp, and his girls were using my apartment.
Oh my God!
While I was at work all day.
Oh my God!
And so this is
wasn't
the kind
ready
of thing.
For that either.
Then I started looking for an apartment, and I put an ad in the Recycler, which is their little rag you know. And so
I'm going to tell about Sonny.
Oh, Sonny. Sonny lived in North Hollywood. He was the last. He was from St. Louis, and he was this. He was a stuntman. He would teach stuntmen. He was old Hollywood. He had the last ranch left over. He was up there over at Kittredge and
middle of the valley, a full ranch,
which was now suburbia. Yeah. But he still had a ranch, and all, and with his horses, and he taught Marilyn Monroe how to ride.
Oh wow!
For that film she did with Robert Mitchum and you know that film, right?
Yeah.
Help me out here.
Misfits.
Thank you. And so I was just doing odd jobs when I got there, and I saw that ad in the Recycler, and he was looking for somebody horsey to help with clean out the stables. And so I worked all different jobs when I got to Hollywood. And then Recycler seemed to be like the place where you could survive and meet people and find some place to live. And John Sonny, that was his name.
And the reason you left?
Dale, you know, we don't have to get into everything.
Because I chased you all around the corral, honey.
It's public radio. And so then I put an ad.
We can talk about it whatever we want.
All right, so I put in an ad looking for a female roommate. Because it just got, you know, first I was looking for a roommate, and then you get people saying, oh, you know, I have a room, and they would have like one room, one bedroom, that was it, and I'd be looking, and there were, you know, there was the Iranian, you know, who was like the nephew of the Shah of Iran, and make your wildest dreams come true. You get everybody answering your ad.
Oh, man.
And calling in the middle of the night. And then I was... and then finally, I found an ad, and it was a great big apartment in Hollywood, you know, two-bedroom, and called Dale. And I thought Dale was a woman, so I called. That's how I met Dale. And he seemed rather normal because he was in New York. And after a while, you figure out how to find the New Yorkers, because they carry books and they don't have a suntan, and they use words like existentialism. And so I met Dale. I came to check out the apartment, and he had a girlfriend, and that was a godsend. So, you know, and he was a really cool guy, struggling actor, and he had another. There was a second little bedroom for me to rent. That's how I met Dale.
Nice.
And we were really good friends for several months. And then after a while, his girlfriend left and went as foolish. She was so foolish. I mean, God bless her. God bless her. She made my life. She owned a house that she returned to. And for that house, she gave up the greatest thing that ever came into my life.
Oh, that's so sweet.
So we'll file that whole thing under the category of even the dumb people are smart in New York.
I think it's really great. I mean, like, just exactly what we're talking about, you know, like it takes all like walks of life to, you know, like people that have done so many different things and gone so many places, like you were just saying before, to tell a great story and to be a character. And you're one of my favorites. And you just told me a great, you guys have been telling me great stories. You know, we're about halfway through the show. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, we'll speak more to Jill DeGroff and Del DeGroff.
Hear that lonesome whippoorwill. He sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is whining low. I'm so lonesome I could cry. I've never seen a night so long when time goes crawling by. The moon just went behind the clouds to hide its face and cry. To die. Like me, he's lost the will to live. I'm so lonesome I could cry. Lights up a purple sky. And as I wonder where you are, I'm so lonesome I could cry.
All right, we are back. You're listening to The Speakeasy. Today my guests are Jill DeGroff and her husband, Del DeGroff. And we were just talking about so many things, actually. We were just telling stories back and forth and talking about, like, characters.
Characters. Yeah.
So when we left the show, we were talking about, right before the break, how you guys met in L.A. What brought you back to New York?
Oh, family. Family. Actually, a few different things happened. Dale was working at the Hotel Bel Air, and things started changing very radically over there. It went from a lovely, intimate little bar. It became corporate owned. And
boo.
And the... Oh, Dale needs to be part of this. Dale, we're talking about the Hotel Bel Air and how it changed hands. And Joe, what was Joe's last name?
Joe Drown.
Because Damon asked me how we came to leave LA and return to New York, and it was a bunch of things. It was your job changing, and
the piano player died.
Bud Herman, yeah, Bud Herman passing away.
Yeah, Bud was a 20-year veteran behind in that room, the lounge at the Hotel Bel Air. He had played with Benny Goodman, was a great player, and he was just one of these great people that brought people together. And when he died, the room changed, and I just didn't want to be there anymore. So there was a chance of doing a bar up in San Francisco, but I couldn't get a job, so we wanted to see family.
We both and we started making babies. We didn't want to raise our kids in L.A.
Yeah, who would?
Because they'd be like talking like, no.
People talk like, no. You know, like this. Sorry, I apologize to Los Angeles listeners.
No, L.A. is totally different now. But back then, the schools were not good, and we, like I said, we didn't have any family around, and we still had grandparents back east, and we wanted them to grow up. That was not fair at all what I said about L.A.
Don't worry about it; they deserve it. No, go continue.
I'm done. I just put my foot in my mouth. I'm done.
No, you're not done.
But one of the things I really like, out of the many things I like about you guys, is that, you know, you've created like a family business out of this industry, you know? I haven't really like spent any time with Blake, but I've talked to Leo several times, and I've had drinks with all of you. and I think it's really cool. And I
you know something, Damon? When you're growing up and you open up your refrigerator and there's nothing but booze, and then you go to the food cabinet, there's nothing but booze.
you start learning. And you learn how to work with that.
Yeah.
So you got back to New York, started getting into the, outside of like the stories about Dale that I know about, like doing the Rainbow Room and everything.
The half of it.
I don't. That's why you're talking to me right now. But I was wondering, like, this is kind of a weird question, but hey, we were talking about how you got started drawing in bars and stuff, but like, I was thinking the other day about this bar on the Lower East Side. It's called Jimmy's Number 43. It's one of the other hosts on one of the other shows here, Beer Sessions with Jimmy. But in that bar, and this is in no way related to your style of artwork.
I wish I'd been there.
It's cool. It's underground. Yeah. It's cavernous. It's really cool. But what they do is they have like people go in there and they draw pictures of like deer and they post them on the wall. But I was just like, for some reason it just snapped up in my head. I was wondering, like, has anyone ever drawn a picture of you and given it to you? I mean, I would imagine at this point.
Oh, not in years. No.
Do you ever do any like self-portraiture or
on the back of my book? That's it.
I mean, I want to draw a picture of you.
Good. I hope you will.
I'm going to keep this bourbon in my hand for now, but I will draw one of you.
Fantastic.
Later. Actually,
an artist?
I'm a guitar player. And I used to do graphic design.
No kidding. Okay.
But as far as drawing, it was always like scribbling.
Me too.
Yeah. But I think there's this old thing. Going in with the whole guitar playing thing is like, as far as even like old country music, there is an old tradition, and you can read about this in all kinds of biographies about different country artists. Like, if they really respected another artist, they would give him their guitar. Like Johnny Cash gave his to Bob Dylan, you know. And I kind of feel that way about like visual artists, you know. It's like, if you really respect someone, you should give them.
I better start carrying a whole bunch of extra pens and paintbrushes with me.
I mean, well, do you actually, do you carry like your whole repertoire, like your mise en place? So
oh, everything is yeah. portable.
Yeah, nice.
And I have my pads and my pens and pencils, and I even have a little watercolor thing in my backpack there.
Oh, cool.
Like I said, I used to always give away my drawings, and now I want to take them home, scan them first, then
I'll keep the originals.
Yeah, but sometimes I end up giving away the originals. I still do some of
very,
that.
You're a very sometimes it's, gracious person.
If I put in many, many hours on it, which often happens, then, you know, want to keep it.
Yeah. It's only understandable.
And but has anybody drawn me? Not in a long, long time. No.
Well, you got to stop hanging around saloons, honey.
Right. People don't draw in saloons.
Well, that oh. brings up an... Oh, go ahead.
One thing there... do you know Nicole Jessamine? Rum, Rum, Room, Room?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She is an extremely talented painter. You know that, right?
Yeah.
And we've been... Often we get together and we get different people like Jordana from Time Out New York.
Love that girl.
Oh, my God. She, and
talk about a character.
Oh, yeah. And Abigail. And so we've been drawing together and, well, painting together. And we get models over to the Rum Rum Room, and we're having such a great time doing that.
Get them drunk, you know what I mean, huh?
Yeah, Joe will come home and start making drinks. And
nice.
And you just...
Did they still have that crazy parrot?
Oh, two of them. Yeah.
Did two?
Yes.
I've only seen the one.
Or three.
Well, one's very quiet, one's very loud.
But you're talking about Sheena.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's a great place, too.
Well, the thing about the two of you drawing together is Nicole is a classicist. I mean, we're talking, you know, Rembrandt style portraits.
Oh my God!
She also caricatures. So the two are so uniquely, you know, special to their own talents. So it's really fun to see the two together.
Yeah, totally, man.
The results of the same pose in the same person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
I can only assume that you're going to ask me to be your next model.
We'd love that. Yeah,
I would. I would not.
Yeah. Oh no. And you know,
do
however
I have to
you
be
want.
Naked?
No. You don't have to be
well,
naked.
I'll totally do it.
And it's actually really fun because the costumes that you know the people in our industry wear, the how they dress, and Frankie is another person we're dying to draw. You know, you just have so much more.
You mean it's going to be like a stick figure?
Do you know? No. Frankie the woman. Frankie.
Oh, Frankie Marshall.
Frankie Marshall.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Frank Cisneros. We always call him Frankie Cocktails, but that joke would have gone over much better if we would have been on the same page.
Oh, but it's so much richer when we're getting these people in the way they dress and the way Abigail dresses and...
And
no life drawing class can give me what I get from these mixologists. That's the thing. I get very bored in life drawing class because they're, you know, I do love anatomy, and but actually, you know, the drawing classes, you're getting a lot of old fat people because, let me not even get into that. And there's nothing wrong. I love big people. Boy, I just keep putting my foot in my mouth. I love big people. And so, but what I'm saying is that when people are naked, when I'm studying anatomy, I do want to do a build that will show me the bone structure. That's what I'm trying to say. And I do love drawing people in all shapes and sizes, but the people the models are getting in the life drawing class, they're just not as interesting as what
you
find.
But you also don't know their story, you know? And I think that's like most of your inspiration is like understanding like where these people, like what
they do. Yes, I want to see them in their
story and their environment.
In their niche.
Yeah,
exactly.
Totally. You can't just like sit in a room with a bunch of other people.
Exactly.
Some classroom.
It's antiseptic, right.
Yeah.
It's not interesting.
Like we were talking about before, it's a
thank you.
Know, the whole
that's what it is.
The whole
they are
idea.
Very interesting people, but they're not. They're thrown into this dry environment,
and you don't know anything about them anyway.
Exactly.
That's what's so cool about like what you're doing with these caricatures is that it's really kind of, you can actually as an artist bring in, you can like breathe it in, you know, what's going on, like the environment. And
I do my best. They're the ones who are making it happen, actually. Oh. You know?
You're making,
they are the characters. Yeah, totally.
I mean, they are. But yeah. You're doing the awesome art.
Thank you.
And, okay, unfortunately, I mean, we're getting kind of short on time, but I want to talk real quick. Do you have a website that people can check out?
Thank you. Saloonartist.com.
Awesome.
And the name of my book is Lush Life Portraits from the Bar, and you can buy it at saloonartist.com. And may I just mention the Museum of the American Cocktail?
Absolutely.
Museumoftheamericancocktail.org.
It's my favorite tiny book.
And we have some fabulous presentations coming up, fabulous mixology presentations, and including Dale is doing a presentation October 5th at the Cornelia Street Cafe.
I want to talk about, okay, cool. If we have to like run a little long, I don't think it's a problem, but okay. I just want to, I've been wondering like what is the significance of the Cornelia Street Cafe to you guys? Because like 3 out of the 5 times that I've gotten to hang out with you guys, it's been at the Cornelia Street Cafe.
He's the, Robin Hirsch is the only person who tolerates us.
It's the oldest sort of cabaret. It's 39 years old on that little tiny one-block-long street, Cornelia Street.
It's on where Mario, Street?
By the way, Mario Poe started his career on that street. David Page, home restaurant, home cookbook, started his career on that same little street. But Cornelia Street Cafe has been there a long, long time, and they've had everybody from Amram, what's his name, the musician. Everybody's been in there. Bob Dylan's been in there. Everybody's been in that little space.
That was Bob Dylan's old stomping grounds.
It's a great little basement like cabaret.
Rooms, kind of that area.
He's had scientists doing lectures in there. He has everything. Storytellers, poets, writers, artists. It's just a cool little spot.
So that was one of your favorite haunts.
Only lately, because when I lived in New York, in Manhattan all those years since 1969, it was not one of my stops. I found it late in life, and I'm in love with it. The reason I found it is because the maitre d' at the Rainbow Room, whose husband owned another great saloon on the west side that writers hung out in, she actually helped Robin open a joint in Brooklyn in Park Slope that he still owns, but didn't turn out to be what they wanted it to be. And that's how I met Robin. I went out to do a little consulting for him at that place, just helping him out with the bar slightly. And then we went back to his other place, and Jill got a... And he hangs art. He hangs art.
Yeah.
And that's how Jill got involved with him, because she hung her art in there.
Well, Robin Hirsch, the owner, proprietor, is such a wonderful, interesting character. And I did a portrait of him, and that's a, then I showed it to him, and he said, how did you do that?
He's a good guy. And it was Dave Amran who once a year for I don't know how many years has appeared at the Cornelia Street Cafe, one of my favorite musicians who plays every instrument known to man, including African, South African, Indian instruments. He's just an incredible musician.
Wow.
He plays there all the time.
Do you guys ever do any music together? Because I know Dell's
she
been...
She plays piano?
I'm not a musician.
Yeah, she plays piano behind me when I'm singing sometimes.
Oh, I'm a two-fingered piano player.
Well, that's how I type.
Just the right two fingers, though.
I was wondering that, because Dale has been playing a lot more, like, I know he's been playing more music lately. Like, the last time I saw you guys at Cornelia Street Cafe, Dale played a couple songs on guitar, and
right.
I didn't know if you guys had ever, like, collaborated.
No, I'm not. Any duets? I'm not a musician, but right now Dale is working with a very talented musician.
Yeah, I'm doing this thing called On the Town, and I actually hired a real guitar player named Joel Perry, who used to play next to me at the bar at the Rainbow Room, to be my accompanist.
Cool. Do you want to play something for us right now?
Oh, hell, why don't we?
Cool. I'll pick up a guitar with you.
Let's do it.
Sweet.
I'll do Lulu, because you mentioned it before, and it's a lot more familiar to me.
Go for it.
Gotta get my old tuxedo pressed, gotta sew a button on my vest, 'cause tonight I got to look my best.
Lulu's back in town. Gotta get a half a buck somewhere. Gotta shine my shoes and slick my hair. Gotta get myself a boutonniere. Lulu's back in town. You can tell all my pets, all my blondes and brunettes, Mr. DeGroff regrets. Oh yeah, he won't be around. You can tell the mailman not to call. I won't be home until the fall, and I might not be back home at all. Lulu's back in town. Oh yes, Lulu's back in town. Uh-huh, Lulu, ba-ba-da-dee's back in town. Ba-da-dee-da-da-bub. Oh yeah.
Nice.
Nice.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. All right, man. You and I, we're going to have to... My band's actually putting out our album right now, so...
Yeah. Why weren't you playing just then? I thought you were joining in, man.
I'll play a song with you.
Well, yeah, two of you.
Let's do how about Hank.
Hank Williams, too.
Hank Williams? I'll totally do Hank Williams.
You ready?
We're going G?
No, I'm starting off in G7, then I'm going to go back to C. I'm doing it in C.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Your cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
Sing it on.
When tears come down like falling rain, you'll toss around and call my name. You'll walk the floor the whole night through.
Your cheating heart will tell on you.
Your cheating heart will pine someday. You tossed away, and love won't come, and you'll be blue. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
That was fun. I haven't played that one in a while, so I'm a little rusty.
I was too, but it was good fun.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I can't tell you guys how much fun I've had on the show today and how awesome it's been to have you on, Jill,
Thank you, Del.
And that's the first time I think I've ever played a song on the show.
Cool.
With anybody. That's a
more of it. More of it. You're good,
this
man.
This is like the 35th episode. I can't remember. Losing track. But it's been one of my absolute personal favorites. Sorry, everyone else.
Do you have a theme song that you end the song that you end it with? Can I bring you out on music if you don't?
Yeah, if you want to play us out,
I'll bring you out.
All right, cool, man.
Thank you, Damon. It's been a
Jill,
pleasure.
Jill, I can't wait to hang out after this and have some pizza at Roberta's. It's been really my pleasure, and thank you so much again for coming on the show. Thanks, and I hope you come back sometime.
We will.
Now that you know where it is. All right, Dale, play us out.
Jada. Jada, 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 jing, jing, jing. Jada, 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 jing, jing, jing. That's a funny little bit of melody. It's so soothing and appealing to me. It goes jada, oh, jada, 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 jing, jing, jing. Oh, yes, jada, jada, jing, jing, jing.
Thanks for listening to The Speakeasy. We got Jill and Del DeGroff in the studio. See you next week.
This is a message from Fork and Anchor. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anchor, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today.
Every spring at the end of kidding season, goat dairies across the country are faced with the question of what to do with their male bucklings. Because on a dairy farm, there's no role for a male. Often the most economical thing for these farmers to do is to cull the animals at birth or ship them off to the commodity market. Heritage Foods USA is embarking on a new project, No Goat Left Behind, looking to step in and fill this niche by creating a marketplace for these male bucklings. Visit us at www.heritagefoodsusa.com to learn more and to reserve your goat this coming October.